And temporarily put everybody on mute. Feel free to jump back into the discussion. And we go right to share screen. Okay. Everybody with me? Can see the screen? Thumbs up if you can see the screen. Right. Okay. We left off with a question. More or less. We spent last week looking at the whole transition of Shalom from this kind of Chevron-centered blew the shofar and declared himself heir to the throne type of thing, to the comes to Yerushalayim and he finds Yerushalayim empty. And whether or not that he had anticipated that, we assumed he did not. And so he kind of finds himself at this moment where he's literally sitting on the throne, not 100% sure he ever expected that or understood what to do with that. And so he ends up in this conversation with Achitofel, tell me what to do, and that kind of moment. But the real question that we asked, and that's where we want to pick up today, is why did David leave Yerushalayim? That's really the critical question. I think that more than anything else is what is the mystery of this parak. Starting with Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayavo HaMagid al David lemor, Haya lev ish Yisrael achrei Avshalom. So the messenger comes to David, the heart of Israel is following Avshalom. Vayomer David lechol avadav asher ito b'Yerushalayim. So he says to all of his servants in Yerushalayim, Kumu v'nivracha. Let us get up and flee. Ki lo tiyeh lanu fleita mipnei Avshalom, that we will not have any survivors, any escape from Avshalom. Maru lalechet, pen yimeher v'hisiganu, quickly, lest he overtake us. V'diach aleinu et hara'ah, and he will bring upon us all the evil. V'hikah ha'ir l'fi charev, and smite the sword, the city with the sword. V'yamru avdei ha'melech al ha'melech, k'chol ha'shi'yivchar adoni ha'melech, hinei avadecha. Servants say to him, behold, your servants will do whatever the king chooses. That's the king's choice. And just from the response of the servants from the Avdei HaMelech, you get a sense that they weren't completely buying or in agreement with David's military assessment. In other words, what David describes here in Perek Yudalid is that we have no chance. We have no chance. The city is lost. And the servants look at some seem or seem to reflect or to convey some bewilderment as to that assessment. But the king is the king, and if he says we are fleeing, we're fleeing. The rest of that story we read last week. So I really want to understand David. What's going on? Think about the oddity of this moment. The notion of, I'm going to stop sharing for a second so I can see everybody. The notion of Yerushalayim falling without so much as a shot. To literally give up on Yerushalayim is quite extraordinary. If you think about what Yerushalayim is, it's a city on top of an enormous hill surrounded by three valleys. It's a natural fortress. It's called a Mitsuda for a reason. When David conquers it initially, it's described as a Mitsudat Tzion. Vayeshev David ba Mitsuda. He sits in this palace, in this fortress, Vayikvale Ir David, and that's when it's given the name Ir David. The effort that David himself has to go through to conquer Yerushalayim from the Jebusites with Yoav. If you remember that whole story, we have a whole discussion about how they entered into the city. The effort that he had to go to, and it was Yoav's creativity and Yoav's energy, and Yoav was the architect of the plan to conquer Yerushalayim. And here David is sitting in Yerushalayim, inside the fortress, with his entire army, with his Tzva Giborim, with Yoav, all ready to protect the city. And it's impenetrable. Nobody is going to be able to take Yerushalayim from David. David chose to defend Yerushalayim. I can't imagine Avshalom with his 200 people, with his ragtag group, with his grassroots army, without any experience, without any formal organizational structure to his army. I cannot see any universe in which Avshalom arrives in Yerushalayim and that battle for Yerushalayim takes more than 10 minutes. I just don't see Yerushalayim falling to Avshalom. And so the real question is not so much why David's assessment is that Yerushalayim is going to fall and he's done and it's finished and there's nothing he can do. That's clearly not the military assessment that the generals are looking at. That's certainly not Yoav's perspective. I don't think it was David's either. I think David presents this sense of Avshalom will come, and Avshalom will conquer, and Avshalom will spare nobody. I think he presents it as an excuse to his people to flee. The real question is why? Why does David abandon Yerushalayim? It's an extraordinary moment, and we need to put it into perspective. Janet, you had a question?
Yeah, I think maybe it's not military, but he feels he's lost the mandate to govern.
Maybe. I don't think so, though, and I'll tell you why. I mean, he certainly understands that Avshalom is, that there's a change here, and that as he leaves Yerushalayim, he understands he is no longer king, right? That he understands. Whether he sees it as lost a mandate or not, maybe. Maybe he just thinks that the people are with Avshalom, and so be it, and he'll accept that. And yet, he offers a tefillah to God, asking him to disrupt the council of Achitophel. He'll plant spies. You will see the spies that he plants. Hushai Ha'arki, his best friend and counsel and confidant, he'll send as a spy into the heart of Avshalom. He even says at the end that if it be God's will, he'll return one day to the kingdom. So I think he always has in his heart the sense that he will one day return. At this point, however, has he lost the will or the sense or the desire to fight for it or the mandate for it? Maybe. Maybe. It's also possible that there's something else going on. And that may be connected. It may be connected. But I think that if we look at David as a kind of the phenomenon, the trends within David's life, I think we'll see there's a pattern that emerges, because when it comes to fighting Israel's enemies, David is quite adept. And David can lead an army together with the best of them. Where David is risk and battle and conflict averse is when it comes to fighting his own. There is a pattern that we've seen since the very beginning of the pursuit, when Shaul was pursuing David, that David will do everything in his power to avoid any kind of conflict with, in some cases, with people of great stature and power like Shaul or Avner, or Ishbosheth, and in some places with people of significant sort of Avner is in the second group, people of significant political status like Avner. But David has been, even places where he's been totally justified and within his means, has always taken a position that he does not want to raise a hand against, raise his hand against his own. And that's been a pattern with David from the very beginning. I'll show you a couple of examples. This is Shmuel Aleph Perakov Dalet. We saw in Shmuel Aleph two examples of his refusal to lift a hand against Shaul, even if A, the circumstances were clearly tactically in his favor, and B, morally justified because David was being pursued for his life by Shaul at that moment. And yet we have the moment when, for example, when David is in the cave hiding and Shaul comes into the cave, and there David takes a little bit of Shaul's garment. Am I in the right place? V'yachlev David otor asher karat kanaf she'el Shaul. He sort of had his heart struck him because he had cut off the little edge of Shaul's garment just to show that he had that ability. God forbid, Ladoni, I will not do this thing to my master, Limashiach Hashem, the anointed of God, Mishloach Yadi Bo, Mashiach Hashem. I will not raise my hand against him because he is Mashiach Hashem. He is the anointed of God, and he is the king, and He's just his son-in-law, just the designated next king. He's just been told by the Navi that Shaul has lost the mandate to govern, but nonetheless, he will not raise a hand against Shaul. We saw that in Perek Chav Dalet and Shmuel Aleph. We saw it again in Perek Chav Vav, which is a very similar story, where Shaul is lying in the field in the middle of the camp. And David goes down together with Avishai ben Tsruya, one of Yoav's brother. And Shaul is lying there asleep, and Avner is with him. And Avishai says to David, "This is your opportunity. Give me the spear and give me the okay, and I will once and for all, with one swoop, I will rid you of your enemy." Vayomer David al Avishai, "Al tashchiteu ki mishalach adom mishiach Hashem minika." Not destroy him. Nobody can lay his hand against God's anointed and be guiltless. And so Chalila Hashem, Shloach Yad, Mashiach Hashem. God forbid that I would set forth a hand against him. So you could say, okay, that's only because Shaul was king. But nonetheless, we see a pattern. If you take a look in Shmuel Bet, Perek Gimel, when Avner, who is a general, it's not the king, and he is the general for Ishbosheth, who is in every sense of the term, Ishbosheth is no different than Avshalom. He's the son of Shaul, and he is illegitimately claiming the throne because the throne had been promised to David. David was already king, and Avshalom had launched a full-scale war, Ishbosheth, but because of Avner, had launched a full-scale effort to retain the kingdom away from David. So there's a certain pattern of parallel to the story of Avshalom. And there, Avner comes, at the end of Perek Gimel, Avner comes to David with an effort to bring peace and unite the kingdom, and David accepts him, and David embraces him, until Yoav shows up. And Yoav, of course, if you remember the story, Yoav gets very angry. And so Yoav calls Avner back, and Yoav kills him. Yoav kills him for many reasons, but Vayakehu Sham Bachomesh Vayamot B'damas Elachiv, one of them being a personal vengeance against the fact that Avner, in the very beginning of the battle, much, much earlier, had killed Yoav's younger brother. When David heard this, he is mortified that the blood of Avner, who really was the general of a rebellious army, but nonetheless, for David, this was a terrible, terrible crime. To gird sackcloth and ashes, receive lifnei Avner, and to lament before Avner. And there are political ramifications to this, but David really saw that as a terrible crime. And then at the end, remember, Ishbosheth is leading a rebellion against David. Ishbosheth is leading a full-scale civil war rebellion against David. And yet at the end, when there are two Givonim that come to him to tell him that they had taken care of his enemy and had killed Ishbosheth, in the next parak, in Perak Dalet, they come to him and they say to him, they bring the head of Ishbosheth to David, as if to say, oh, the head of your enemy, you see? Ishbosheth ben Shaul, your enemy. David is mortified. Vayan David et rechaved bana achiv b'nei mimona be'oti v'yom alehem. Chai Hashem. He takes an oath and he says, "Amagid lemoi name met Shaul." When somebody came to tell me that Shaul had died, and he was just coming to tell me the news, I killed him for it. Okay, that's the beginning of Shmuel Bet. Afki anashim rashim hargu et ish tzadik beveito. And now you wicked people who have killed a righteous person sleeping in his bed. David is, you know, when we think about all of the conflicts in David's life, it's really extraordinary that he has this sense, this moral sense, that there's a foundational difference between picking up a sword against your brother or your son or your cousin or whatever circumstance there is versus the circumstance of fighting your wars against your enemies. And so you have this aversion to these kinds of internal battles within the people. And now this has turned against him in his own household, meaning it's his own son Avshalom who's marching on Yerushalayim. So from one sense, it's hard to imagine that David has, well, at least certainly I think it's perceived this way, that David has, call it the stomach, for a full-scale battle against Avshalom. And certainly not in Yerushalayim. We'll talk about the status of Yerushalayim in a second. He will be forced into a battle against the army of Avshalom. That's clear. That's how the rebellion comes to a head. And even there, David's last command to his soldiers are to spare Avshalom, even though Avshalom is the catalyst to all of it. Partially because he's a son, and partially because he's the prince, and partially because it's just not David. So there is that element to it. I think that there's something to be said for that, that he's sort of averse to the whole experience of this kind of conflict. But I want to put that out there as a possibility. I think there's another possibility, however, that may be at play that is no less significant than, well, again, which of these two are really the kind of the core motivating factors here, or whether there's a third element, we'll talk about in a minute. But there's another element driving the mindset of David that I think we need to acknowledge, and that is that David lives with the ghosts of his past. And what I mean by that specifically is this: there's an interesting phrase. When David speaks to his people and he says to them, "Vayomer David l'avachol avadav asher ito b'Yerushalayim, Kumu v'nivracha." We're going to run away. Gilot yelan pleita, there'll be nobody left. There'll be nobody to escape the wrath of Avshalom. Quickly let us go. V'sigu, lest he catch up to us. V'idiach aleinu atara'a, and bring down the evil upon us. V'hika ha'ir lefi charev, and smite the city by the sword. There's a language here that should resonate and remind us of a kind of the notion of David sitting in Yerushalayim, being attacked by Avshalom. He presents the story almost as if, remember, he takes the men, the women, the children, everybody. He empties the city. He almost presents the story as if he's afraid of a massacre. Now, again, militarily, I don't think there's any possibility of that happening. But from David's perspective, he's not taking the chance, because he's living with a ghost of the past. What ghost is he living with?
The killing of the Kohanim in Nov, maybe.
Yeah, the city of Nov. The city of Nov. David has always lived with the guilt of the massacre of the city of Nov. And remember, the story of the city of destruction of Nov wasn't just the Kohanim. The entire city was destroyed. The city was razed. The men, women, and children, everybody was massacred. Doeg left no survivors. And, that's not true. He left one survivor. If you go back to Shmuel Aleph Perek Chav Bet, and we go back to the story of, and remember, just to put us back into the story, what happened? David was fleeing from Shaul. Shaul was trying to kill him. And he escaped after the conversation with Yonatan, where he was hiding in the fields for a couple of days in the Rosh Chodesh party. And he had nothing to eat for those couple of days. And he leaves. And we talked about the fact that Yonatan didn't bring him any food. So he left literally starving after 3 days of not eating. And the first place he comes to is the city of Nov. He goes straight to Nov. And gathers a group of people. One second, let's just, actually, no, that's already the previous, the next parak. I think the story of Nov is the previous parak. Vayavo David Nove El HaMelech HaKohen. He comes to Nov, to Achimelech the Kohen. Why are you alone? And David says to him, makes him an excuse. And he says, what do you have to eat? Five loaves of bread. Fine. Nabiyadi. Give them to me. Whatever you have. He's starving. So the Kohen says to him, I have nothing except the lechem upon him. There's a whole discussion about why he's allowed to eat the lechem upon him. And then he asks for a weapon. He has no weapons, so he gives him the cherev. He gives him the sword of Goliath, which had been stored there. Shaul hears about all of this, and he sends Doeg Edomi to. He says to his people, you Binyaminites, how dare you, you've conspired against me, not telling me where Ben Yishai is hiding. So Yoeg Adomi says, Doeg Adomi was set over the servants of Shaul, and he says to him, I saw David in Nov. And he asked of God, and God gave him the food, and he gave him the sword of Goliath. So now he's not only replenished, he's also armed, which Shaul sees as an act of treason. So King called Achituv, and he says to him, is this true? And why have you conspired against me? Ben Yishai is to give him food and to give him a sword. Nobody is more loyal to you than David, says Achimelech to Shaul. Chatan HaMelech is the son-in-law of the king. Why would he do anything but? You, Achimelech, will die. You and your father's house. The king says to the guard who was there, Sobu v'amitu kone Hashem, go and slay the priests of God, ki gam yadamim David, they supported David. So then nobody wanted to do it. The people were refused. Right? The people were afraid. They didn't want to do such a terrible thing. So the king says to Doeg, so you do it. So he killed the Kohanim, and he killed 85 Kohanim at that time. That's just in the Mishkan. That Nov ir HaKohanim hikal lefi cherev, he took the entire city of Nov and he killed it by the sword. Me'ish v'yadisha me'olel v'yad yonek v'shor v'chamor v'sel v'icharev. Left no survivors. That's the piece of the story we don't always pay attention to. It wasn't the Kohanim who he killed. It was a massacre of the entire city. And one person survived. Vayimalet ben echad la'achimelech ben achituv. Who is that one survivor, ben a son of Achimelech? Evyatar Kohen. And Evyatar remains with David until the end. Evyatar was one of the two people that he was talking to here as he's leaving in Yerushalayim, Evyatar and Tzadok. Evach achrei David. When he comes to David, Vayaged Evyatar le David ki erag Shaul et Kohanei Hashem, when he tells David what Shaul had done and what Doeg had done, look at David's response. Vayomer David le Evyatar, yadati bayom ahu. You know what? I knew on that day when I was there in Nov, I knew Kisham Doeg Ha'adomi. I knew that Doeg was there. I saw him. Ki aged yagid l'Shaul. And I knew that he would go and tell Shaul. In other words, it's all my fault. And that's exactly what he says. Anochi saboti b'chol nefesh beit avicha. The death of all of your father's house is on my head, David says. Because I should have been more careful, because I knew that Doeg was there, and I went anyway. And then he says, okay, fine. So if Yatari says, you stay with me and I'll protect you, etc. The rest of the story is not our issue. But this notion from Shmuel Ala Perkopet, this story of Nov, has been a part of David's past, and has haunted him, and has stayed with him all of these years. And when you hear the phrase that he killed the entire city, men, women, and children, l'ficharev, by the sword, and then you hear David say to his people, we're going to leave Yerushalayim because Avshalom is coming to attack Yerushalayim, and there will be none left. Lo tiyeh lanu pleita. They'll smite the city by the sword. There's a certain part of it that kind of resonates or kind of reminds us of the language of, reminiscent of the language of the destruction of Nov. And David is overprotective of the civilian population of Yerushalayim, precisely because he's afraid of another Nov, and that's something which he's not prepared to do. So that's a second possibility. So on the one hand, he's risk averse to anything that stands like a civil war within his own family, and second of all, I think he is living a little bit with the ghost of the story of Nov in this context. Two possibilities. The third possibility, I think Janet correctly points out, is that he's felt a little bit of the guilt of the loss of the mandate to govern and kind of takes that with him, although we'll talk a little bit about that at the end as well. But I think there's a third element here. And the third element, I think, is the most, to me, the most dramatic and the most important. And that is not just about the aversion to civil war and not just about the fear of Nov. If this was any other city, I would say maybe David would have had a different response. But we're talking about Yerushalayim. And I think what happens here is significant because it's Yerushalayim. So I'm going to go down a few psukim to the conversation that he has with the Kohanim. V'hinei gam tzadok v'chol ha'levi'im ito nos'im et aron brit ha'elokim. As he's leaving Yerushalayim, together with him come Tzadok, and we'll see Avyatar as well, together with the Aron Brit Ha'elokim. V'yomer ha'melech l'tzadok. King turns to Tzadok and he says to him, Hashev et Aron Elokim ha'ir. Take the Aron Ha'elokim back to the city. Im emtzachem b'nei Hashem, eshivani v'yerani oto v'et naveyo. if at some point in the future God finds, I find favor in God's eyes, and he finds it favorable to return me, then I will once again merit to see the Aron and its home, its habitation, its Nave. Ani oto ve'et Nave. This return of the Aron is really the most remarkable part of it, because the Aron is whether it's the Aron with the Brit or the with the Luchot or the Aron with the Urim v'Tumim. Either way, the Aron represents the a vehicle by which David can it's like a secret weapon by which he can communicate with God before he goes to battle. He takes this secret weapon and he returns it to Yerushalayim. What's going on here? You know, in a very real sense, this is probably the most significant moment in David's life. And I don't want to understate that. Because what David has done here in this one act and in this one sentence has transformed the status of Yerushalayim forever. And I want to explain that statement. Up until this moment, I'm going to stop sharing because we'll come back to the text. Up until this moment in time, Yerushalayim has a status of what? Where's the significance of Yerushalayim? In the eyes of the people, in the eyes of David, in the eyes of the army, in the eyes of everybody, what is Yerushalayim?
The seat of the kingdom.
That's it. That is it. It is David's city. It is the capital of David's kingdom. Beyond that, it has no status. I want to reiterate something which we talked about back when we learned Perek Hey, when David conquers Yerushalayim. All the stories and traditions of Yerushalayim that go back to Sefer Bereishit, the place of the Akedah and the place where that will become the Harashem Yira'eh and the foundation stone and the Eben Hashdiyah and all of the pieces of Yerushalayim. They're all unknown. Meaning, the people know that there's this place in Sefer Bereishit. They know the stories of Sefer Bereishit. But there is no tradition that links the specific locations that those places have to the people in the period of Yoshua and the period of Shoftim. If there were, then they would not have left Yerushalayim unsettled, unconquered, and untouched for 400 years. 400 years, they're living everywhere but Yerushalayim. Yevus is a Gentile city. Because it has no significance, and they don't know of Yerushalayim in any sense other than it's a city that borders between Shevet Yehudah and Shevet Binyamin. When David goes to conquer Yerushalayim, he does so because it's a border city, because it's a way of uniting the kingdom. And nobody, when it was such a difficult conquest, nobody wanted to touch it. So he conquers it, and he takes it, and he makes it the border city, and he unites the kingdom. And for all intents and purposes, it's the political capital of Malchut David. But it's associated with the context of David's Malchus, and solely with David's Malchus. When David moves the Aron from its hiding place in Kiryat Yarim to Yerushalayim, he doesn't do so because he knows that Yerushalayim is destined to be the place of the Mikdash and the Bahar Hashem and the Shechina will never abandon Yerushalayim and all of those rationales. He moves the Aron to Yerushalayim because that's where his capital is, and he needs to bring the religious and political context of it together. When Yerevan ben Nevat will separate from the northern, from the southern kingdom and create a northern kingdom breakaway, in Malachim Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph, right? A whole bunch of years later, in the after Shlomo Melech. What's the first thing he's going to do? Right? He's going to have to figure out a way to separate the people from Yerushalayim. And so there is a certain association of the temple with the kingdom. So he'll bring and he'll create Agalim. He'll create his own form of temple in his location and in his northern kingdom. He places the Agalim, one in Dan and one in Betel. Because that's what kings did. So it was normal for David to want to bring the Aron to Yerushalayim. It was a political move. At least that was how it was seen. The association is between David's kingdom and Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim has no status. If David leaves Yerushalayim, if David abandons the capital, then what's the status of Yerushalayim? Nothing. It's gone. Hey, there's no status to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim loses any significance the moment the kingdom of David comes to an end, the seed of David comes to an end. Because Yerushalayim was only a significant city because David had moved his capital there. The capital had always been Hebron. David chose to go to Yerushalayim at great personal risk. He went to Yerushalayim. Now he's being forced out of Yerushalayim. So for all intents and purposes, that'll be the end of, or either Avshalom will manage to reestablish the next line of the kings in Yerushalayim, or he'll choose some other city to be his capital. But Yerushalayim, from a status perspective, is linked to David's political arena. Vayikra le'ir David. In this one act, David has done something extraordinary, unprecedented, and transformative to Yerushalayim for eternity. He's taken the Aron and he says to his people, the Aron now goes back to Yerushalayim. He's essentially separated the spiritual destiny and fate of Yerushalayim, the spiritual connection between Yerushalayim and the Mikdash and the Shekhinah and the all of those pieces. He's connected them all to Yerushalayim as a city that is now independent of David himself. That's unheard of. But what it does is it transforms Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim takes on a status and identity now that is totally independent of David. David is in exile. Avshalom may or may not continue to stay in Yerushalayim. But Yerushalayim will remain the place of the Aron. Yerushalayim will remain the place of the Shekhinah. Now, again, I don't think it's because of any connection to Sefer Bereishit. It's not connected to the story of the Akedah. It's not connected to, any of that. We'll talk a little bit about why he does so. But it's connected much more to the fact that he's now placed the Aron, right? He hasn't even bought the place for the Mikdash yet. That story of Aravna hasn't happened yet. He's now going to place the Aron in Yerushalayim and say, this is the Naveh. This is the city of the Aron. This is the city of the Shekhinah. That's really extraordinary. I go back to the psukim, right? Imim tzachem b'nei Hashem b'shivani v'hirani oto v'et naveyo. If God wills it, I will again see the Aron and its habitation, its home. It will be home. So if there's ever a point in time in Tanakh where we can point and say, this is where Yerushalayim gets the status of being the place of the Shekhinah, the Rambam who paskins that the Shekhinah never leaves Yerushalayim, and that even if the original Kedusha was bottled, the Kedusha of Yerushalayim is never bottled because Yerushalayim has a status independent of any political entity, etc. All of that starts here. It doesn't start in Bereishit. It starts the moment David chooses to take the Aron and place it in Yerushalayim, independent of the Malchus. Yerushalayim is a status. That's fascinating. If I show you the story of the split of the kingdom, I'll show you a couple of interesting verses. This is Shmuel Bet. No, we did already. Shmuel Bet, okay. Yeah. Malachim Aleph. This is where Shlomo Melech builds the Beit HaMikdash and dedicates the Beit HaMikdash. And in that response, God comes to Shlomo, and he offers actually it starts with a prayer of Shlomo himself. Yomer Baruch Hashem Elokei Yisrael Asher Diber Befi V'David Avi. Blessed is God who spoke with David, my father, Uviadom Milei Lemor, and promised David and fulfilled that promise, saying, Minayom Asher Hotzeti Et Amit Yisrael Mimitzrayim Lo Bacharti Be'ir Mechoko Shiftei Yisrael. When the Jews left Egypt and they came into the land of Israel, and they lived under Yeshua, and they lived under the Shoftim, and the Shoftim ruled in all the different places, at no point was there ever a designated city that God said, this is my city. Lo bacharti be'ir mikol shiftei Yisrael, livnot bayit liyot shmisham, as a permanent place of the bayit. Ve'efchar b'David liyot alami Yisrael, I chose instead David. It's a really interesting pasuk because he's talking about the choice of Yerushalayim to the place of the Mikdash. And what he says is, no, it's not about Yerushalayim. God didn't choose Yerushalayim. God chose David. David chose Yerushalayim. And David chose to make Yerushalayim the place of the Bayit to God, regardless of whether David sat there. That's what's extraordinary. That's what's unprecedented. And the reason David chose Yerushalayim was also fascinating. David didn't choose Yerushalayim because it had a historical context to his story, to his tribe, to his malchus, because it had a historical significance to the story of the Jewish people, and that it was an archaeological find, and it was the city from the days of the Avot. No, David chose Yerushalayim for one reason. Because it would unite the warring tribes of Israel, because it would unite the tribes of Shaul and the tribes of David together, because it was the border between the two kingdoms. That was the sole reason he chose Yerushalayim, despite it being so difficult. Can you imagine now a civil war between Yerushalayim and Hebron? It's unheard of. It's impossible. David says, I can't do it. I can't do that. The whole purpose of Yerushalayim was to unite the tribes. I'm not going to let Yerushalayim become a symbol of a civil war between myself and Avshalom. I'd rather be mevat. I'd rather give up on Yerushalayim. I'd rather put the Aron back in Yerushalayim and I'll leave than allow Yerushalayim to become the seat of a civil war between David and Avshalom. That civil war will become intense. 20,000 people are going to die in that battle. Plus, David is not going to make Yerushalayim the battleground to divide the people when he worked so hard to make Yerushalayim the symbol of the unity of the Jewish people. Yerushalayim as a status is completely the choice of David HaMelech, both in terms of its status as the unifying factor of the people, as well as its choice as the city of the Mikdash, the city of the Aron. So I did not choose this city. David, I chose David. David chose the city. And David chose at the moment he chose to put the Aron back in Yerushalayim, even if he leaves. There's a question. Somebody had a question. Robbie had a question. Robbie, you there? You're on mute.
How come David wasn't concerned that Avshalom would move it? I mean, if this was David's arbitrary decision, Avshalom could move it when he took over Jerusalem after it was vacated.
He could, but why would he?
Why not? He'd move his capital somewhere else.
Doing is he's handing it all over to Avshalom and says, okay, you now become the king, but be the king in Yerushalayim, because that's the place of the Shechina. That's the place of the Aron. So there's no reason for him to.
Right.
And no king ever did. It's fascinating. In the history of Malchut Beit David, no king ever chose, no king from the house of David, no king from the house of David ever chose to move his capital somewhere else. And no king in Yerushalayim was ever appointed who wasn't from the house of David. I want to say that again. There's a lot of conflict in the story of Tanakh and the story of the kingdoms. And there'll be a split in the kingdom. There'll be a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. And the southern kingdom will be the house of David and his remnants. You know what? Before I even get there, let me show you the next pasuk. This will become easier to understand after I show you one more source. Malachim Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph. This is where the kingdom is split. I think we once talked about this back in the question of the study of Perek Zion, of why David wasn't allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash. It's a fascinating conversation that takes place here. Yeravam ben Nevat goes, actually, let's start from God's message to Rechavam, son of Shlomo. He says to him, "Vayomer Hashem li Shlomo." Well, to Shlomo, actually, it's not to Yeravam. This is to Shlomo, after Shlomo's mistakes. "Vayomer Hashem li Shlomo, Yaan asher hayta zot imcha v'lo shamarta briti v'chukotai, because you did not listen to my brit and my statutes, which I commanded you. I'm going to tear the kingdom away from you. I'm going to give it to somebody else, to your servant. I won't do it in your lifetime. Because for the sake of David, I promised David his son would sit on the throne. I will not do so during your lifetime. But your son, I will tear the kingdom apart. But I won't tear the entire kingdom apart. I will give your son one tribe. For the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Yerushalayim, which I have chosen." Now look at this phrase carefully. "Leman David Avdi," for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Yerushalayim, Asher Bacharti. Asher Bacharti is what? Is Asher Bacharti reference to Yerushalayim? God chose Yerushalayim? Or is Asher Bacharti reference to David? David Asher Bacharti. David, whom I have chosen. Or both? Leman David Abdi Asher Bacharti and Leman Yerushalayim Asher Bacharti. The fascinating pasuk. But the association between David and Yerushalayim is very clear. I will give one shevet to your son Shlomo for the sake of David and for the sake of Yerushalayim. Now, hold that thought for a second. And we're going to go to the nevuah of Achiah Shiloni and Yeravam ben Nevat. So Yeravam ben Nevat is this servant, this upstart, who will eventually, from Shevet Ephraim, will eventually split the kingdom apart. And there he has this conversation with... Chia Shiloni, let me just jump a little bit further. "Vahi be'etahiv Yeravam yatzam Yerushalayim." At that time, Yeravam leaves Yerushalayim. "Ve'imtzato Chia Shiloni." Chia Shiloni finds him, and he says to him, "U'mitkaseh b'salma." He had been wearing this new cloak, salma chadasha. And the two of them are alone in the field. "Va'itpos Achia b'salma chadasha shvalav." Achia took hold of the new garment that was upon him. Unclear whether it's Achiah's garment or Yeravam's garment. Same issue we had with Shaul and Shlomo. And he tore it into 12 pieces. Okay, so how many tribes are there?
12 tribes.
He tears it into 12 pieces. Now, how many tribes is it going to give to Shlomo? What did we say? One. Which means that how many tribes is he going to leave to Rechavam? Do the math. 12 minus one is?
11.
You sure?
No, because the tribe of Levi
12
is...
minus one is?
10.
12 minus one is 11. Right?
Except okay. There's Levim.
Explain to me why he says, "V'yomer li'Yeravam, kach lecha asara kna'im." You take 10 pieces. Kikoma Hashem Elokei Yisrael. This is what God says. I'm going to give you, as God says, 10 tribes. Leaving how many for David? For Shlomo? For David?
One.
And I will leave one tribe for David, for the sake of Yerushalayim, the city which I have chosen. So all the Mefarshim go like this. They go, huh? 10 plus 1 equals 12. Am I missing something? You hear the problem?
Yeah, I hear the math
problem. Levi is for Hashem.
So the answer to this question is very simple. You have to read this pasuk exactly the same way we read the previous one. One tribe for the sake of David, my servant. And the other shevet for the sake of Yerushalayim. In other words, God doesn't leave Shlomo with one tribe, he leaves Shlomo with two. Because Yehavam ben Nevat splits the, if you know, remember the map, remember the geography of Israel, Yerushalayim, north of Yerushalayim is the tribe of
Binyamin.
Shaul was from the tribe of Binyamin. I'm going to stop sharing for a second. North of Yerushalayim is the tribe of Binyamin. Shaul is from the tribe of Binyamin. The split between David and Shaul, the war between David and Ish-bosheth, was between Yehudah and Binyamin. That's why David puts the capital in Yerushalayim, because it would unite the two warring factions. Yehavam ben Nevat is from Shevet Ephraim. Ephraim is just north of Binyamin. When Yehavam ben Nevat splits the kingdom apart, he splits the kingdom apart at Beit El. Beit El is the border between Shevet Binyamin and Ephraim. In other words, Binyamin stays with Yehuda. And that makes no sense whatsoever, because for all the years the conflict was between Yehuda and Binyamin. They were the two competing factions for the Malchus. Why on earth would Binyamin stay with Shlomo, Binyamin stay with Yehudah, and not go with the Northern Kingdom? And the answer is very simple. Because if Binyamin went with the Northern Kingdom, what would happen to Yerushalayim?
It would go north.
It would become back, it would revert back to being the border between the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. And that would be the end of Yerushalayim as any kind of status. That's precisely God's promise to David and to Shlomo. I will give you one tribe, the tribe of Yehudah, Laman David Avdi, and I will give you a second tribe for the sake of Yerushalayim, to preserve the unity and integrity of Yerushalayim as the capital of that kingdom, as the place of the Mikdash, as the center of that kingdom. And for that, I have to annex Binyamin into the southern kingdom so that Yerushalayim stays at the center. Yerushalayim cannot be split. Yeah, go ahead.
So Levi, it doesn't count.
Not in the division of land.
Is it 12 tribes where you have Ephraim and Manasseh, and Levi doesn't count?
Correct. Okay. You only ever have 12. If you're looking at territory, Ephraim and Manasseh as tribes, then you're looking at 12, because you're not counting Levi. Right. They have cities scattered throughout the country. If you're looking at the children of Yaakov, so there are 12, and then but Yosef gets replaced with Ephraim and Manasseh. So anytime you're talking about the land division and tribes, you're talking about 12 Ephraim and Manasseh's too.
Okay, so now, since I have your attention, I put a question in the chat.
Okay.
When chronologically was the story where David gets the vision that Yerushalayim is the place for the Beit HaMikdash.
Yes.
Because I remember you saying that it wasn't chronological.
It's not chronological. It's unclear where that story fits into the picture. We'll eventually get to that. Somewhat of a mystery, where to put it.
Okay. But you don't think that he knew at this point where he's fleeing Avshalom that was the place for the Beit HaMikdash?
I don't think it would have mattered. Meaning, even if he did know that at that point there was that.
Well, if he did know, then that makes sense. That's what you're, you know, if he didn't know, then you're saying, yes, he
would have made
on his own that this should be the place.
It's still his choice. Because even if that Nevuah had existed at the time, when he was still king in Yerushalayim, the message being, okay, this is of the places, options that we have in Yerushalayim, here's the place. But it still doesn't leave the possibility, it still leaves open the possibility of leaving Yerushalayim, abandoning Yerushalayim, and building it somewhere else, whether permanently or temporarily.
Because
remember, the Aron goes with him. So his choice at that point is basically to make a choice. It's not about the Aron. It's about Yerushalayim. Mm-hmm. And Janet, this comes back to what I think you alluded to earlier, where we talked about the fact that he kind of sees himself as losing the mandate. It's not so much the mandate he loses, but there was a certain amount of acceptance that David goes through in this experience because of the fact that you have the Nevuah of Natan, and he knew eventually he would lose the kingdom. Shaul lost the kingdom for far less. So, and Natan's Nevuah to him, which is that you're about the women in this household and about the kingdom and about the tearing the kingdom away from him and all of those pieces that were part of the Nevuah of Natan to him, eventually he knew that he would leave Yerushalayim. Or that he would lose the mandate, or they could foresee the events having developed the way they were. There's a certain amount of acceptance of Kabbalat HaDin in David's frame of reference here in this story. I think that's clear. I don't think you can read the story and not see David kind of resigned to the fact that there is a hand of directing the show here that's beyond the scope of the things that he has, that he can control. And so there's this acceptance, right? He says it. He says it in the text. Let's go back to this text for a second, a very important pasuk. V'yomer melech tzedok ha-shevet aron alakim ma'ir im emtza chen b'enei Hashem me'eshimani mihirani oto ve'et naveyam. If I find favor in God's eyes, then maybe I will be merit to come back one day and see both the city and its inhabitants. Mitzvah, one day, hopefully. But if not, there is a resignation here that is extraordinary, an acceptance of God's decree. This is by God's hand, he says. And therefore, he's not going to fight God's hand. He sees it as such. He sees it as whether the natural consequences or the punishment for all of that is taking place with Bathsheba. He sees the Nevuah of Natan that is here. He has reasons to want to leave Yerushalayim and not to fight for Yerushalayim. He's not going to let Yerushalayim become the center of a civil war when he fought so hard to make Yerushalayim the center of the unity to unite the people together. And so he will rather give up on Yerushalayim himself than to see blood shed over Yerushalayim. That's the critical piece. He has a rational, reasonable understanding of why he felt at this moment he would rather leave Yerushalayim than see Yerushalayim spill a single drop of bloodshed. Yerushalayim, by its definition, has to unite the people. In David's eyes, that's what it was for. But he goes one step further. And he says he'll take the Aron and send it back to Yerushalayim and transform Yerushalayim into the eternal place, the symbol of the breed between God and Israel. That's already an extraordinary moment. And that's this sense of I accept what has happened to me. What has happened to me is because of my own faith. This is part of that onish. But Yerushalayim shall remain for eternity the place of the Neveh of the Shekhinah, the habitation, the place, the home of the Aron. That's really the centerpiece here.
Rabbi, he never lets go of his dream.
Sorry, say that again?
I said he never lets go of his dream to make sure the Beit HaMikdash is built.
That's correct. I mean, that's been his dream since this whole story started. That's ultimately that story. If you look at the sequence of events from Perek Hay, when he comes to Yerushalayim, then he brings the Aron to Yerushalayim in Perek Vav, then he wants to build the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim in Perek Zion, and he's told no because he doesn't have an heir to the throne because he had this conflict with Michal, and so back in Perek Vav, and so that line, a lineage that linked to Shaul, is now done, so he has no heir to the throne. Perek Chet is a series of wars over Yerushalayim, and Perek Tet is the battle with Ammon. Perek Yud is the continuation of the battle of Ammon. Perek Yud Aleph is the story of Bathsheba. And you can see in David's mind the search for an heir to the throne so that he can eventually build the Mikdash. Right? It's or his son can build a Mikdash. You can see the cogs turning. although in the wrong direction. The story of Batsheva was right, had its own failings. But here he's leaving Yerushalayim and he's accepted all the consequences for what has happened to him. Yerushalayim is not going to pay that price. And so he gives up in Yerushalayim. He says Yerushalayim can remain part of Avshalom's kingdom, but the place of the Shechina will remain in Yerushalayim. Really extraordinary piece, all connected to David's choice of what Yerushalayim represents for him. And he will not allow Yerushalayim to become the center for that conflict and civil war. He'll take it to the streets. He'll take it out to the forest of Yar Ephraim, if need be. He'll cross over the Yarden, and he will engage with Avshalom. You have no choice. But not Yerushalayim. And not Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is, as a symbol of the unity of Israel, can't be tainted. And so he takes the ark and he sends it back. Somebody had a question? No? All right. That more or less brings us to, believe it or not, we finished 10 minutes early. That more or less brings us to the end of what I wanted to cover today. It would to start a whole new piece of his conversation with Hushai Ha'aki, and it's kind of a different direction altogether. I want to we'll stop a few minutes early. I just want to reiterate something which I spoke about at the beginning of this year. So two things. Number one, I will let you know about next week. Still trying to figure out my schedule for next week, whether or not we'll have a shiur or stop here until after Pesach. So look out for a notice from me, number one. Number two, that WhatsApp group, if you are able to join, if you haven't done already, it'll just make my life a little easier to be able to communicate over WhatsApp. If you saw it in the email, great. If you did not, I put the text in the chat. I'm going to put it here as well. That's just a single click link to join the group on the WhatsApp group. And that way we have a way of communicating in real time rather than through email, where for some reason today people are less diligent about checking their email than they are about checking their WhatsApp. All right, questions? No, then enjoy the rest of the day and enjoy the extra 10 minutes that I have bequeathed to you. So have fun.
More cleaning.
Thanks. Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you, Rabbi.
Very good cheer. I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Very interesting. Loved it.
You're welcome.